This is Agri Futures on Air, brought to you by Agri Futures Australia, driving innovation in Australian agriculture.
Hello, I'm Jane Cudahy. For many Australians, the mention of seaweed conjures up awkward moments at the beach fishing it out of their hair, or maybe tucking into a delicious and intricately wrapped roll of sushi. But it turns out that we love it. In fact, we adore it. As a nation, we import over $1.1 billion worth of seaweed annually to use in everything from shampoo to aforementioned foodstuffs. The cosmetics and health industries in particular have a high demand for seaweed products, but the domestic production of it is basically non-existent. Adrian Spencer is the founder and CEO of Sampano, a company aiming to refine value chains to support Australian organisations. Adrian and his team have been researching ways more seaweed can be produced sustainably within our own shores. In fact, his research has earned him the inaugural AgriFutures Australia Researcher of the Year accolade. Adrian's personal story of how he became a researcher and is now focusing on seaweed is a fascinating tale.
I grew up and lived in Beechworth in northeast Victoria, and I was fortunate at that time that the universities were starting to set up regional campuses. So Wodonga had their first year of freshwater ecology, biological sciences. I started there, enrolled in that course, and did my first year there. Had been doing a lot of my holiday work and vacation work to support my studies at a local farm. And after our first year of studies, we were then transferred to Melbourne to complete our degree. And I was studying botany and geology and had to pick which way to go.
How did you do that? Because they're two quite different fields. Is it sort of pick your favourite or pick where you think the opportunities lay?
Yeah, it was really hard to decide, actually. I thought it would have been easier. I grew up collecting gemstones and crystals, and that was the reason my parents moved to Beechworth when I was born. So I was always out in the bush, and I loved it, and I had a natural affinity for it. And I found that with geology, it was one of those sciences that was just so practical that you could touch and you could feel and you could see it all around you, and you could very quickly use it to make sense of the world. And for my style of thinking and like being outdoors, it was great. Having also started with freshwater ecology, our lecturer loved to get us out into the field. As soon as we could get out of the classroom, he would take us out. Even on weekends, wasn't part of the coursework, he'd say, let's go and find this rare native endangered bird. We'll see if we can get a photo of it. Or we'd go down to the local ponds and collect some sludge and analyse it. Or he'd just got a new electric fishing rod, which was a fantastic way of collecting fish, so you could sample them and test them and measure them and do all those scientific things. And you just put it in the water and turn it on, and the fish would swim straight towards the rod, and all you had to do was scoop them up. Although I remember the first time he did it, he said he was so keen with the net that he didn't want to miss it, that he saw the fish, he scooped in, caught the fish, and then the operator said, I haven't even turned the rod on yet.
Oh.
but just getting out, having all those experiences, really, you know, which is what drove my interest and my love for science. I ended up choosing geology. I discovered it paid really well. It was the third highest paying profession for graduates at
that
the time.
That makes it easy, doesn't it?
Well, it was pretty attractive, and I was offered a scholarship, and I worked for Rio Tinto and worked for North Limited, and they put me on a graduate program. They took me all around Australia. I did 6 months many of their bases and locations, and really got to see the countryside and fell in love with doing that. So I did that for 5 years and met my wife on my travels and decided it was time for a career change. Ended up back in Melbourne looking for a new career, something different. I ended up working at Ernst & Young in their taxation division.
That's amazingly different to what you've even – all of your other interests that you've just mentioned.
It felt like a 180 sort of pivot, but – interestingly, they were working with companies that were doing research and development, and they wanted somebody who could help them to write the grant applications to secure R&D funding, and they needed somebody who could help speak the language and understand the nature of research. So they started sending me out back all over the countryside to all different industries, mainly mining, agriculture, and manufacturing, to work with those organisations to secure funding so that they could continue or increase the level of research that they were doing in their respective fields.
Okay, when you put it like that, it makes sense. Now you're working in seaweed. So how did you leave that particular career and come back to the outside, to these kind of sciences with practical applications?
Yeah, we continue to do a lot of the financial support for research in industry around Australia, and that led us into the nutraceutical industry. And by nutraceutical industry, I'm talking about the vitamin and health companies. And we started to work with them, and they were saying to us, look, a lot of our products are imported from overseas. So $1 billion of product comes into Australia, either as sort of extracted or active ingredients. And then they're turned into capsules, tablets, skincare products, healthcare products, and then they're sold into the local and export markets. But they were saying to us, what we'd really like to do is tap into Australian products. We would like to work through the local value chain. And as we looked into it, we discovered, well, there isn't really a value chain. It doesn't really exist. Most primary producers are either doing fresh food or processed food, but selling into the nutraceutical industry doesn't really happen. And so we started to say, how would we join those dots? How would we connect those buyers to the primary producers and what would be required? That started us down a path of exploration, saying, well, what products do they need? And are those products ready to go from farm gate into these processing factories? And we realised there was a really big gap. The answer was no, even though there was strong interest from primary producers who were keen to diversify, tap into new markets, either find use for their waste or grow specifically for nutraceuticals. What we found was we didn't know which varieties we needed. We didn't know whether the extractive processing was available to get the active ingredient out of the raw ingredient. If we wanted something like lycopene, which is used in a lot of multivitamins and is a great antioxidant, and it comes out of tomatoes, we found lots of tomato growers, but we found nobody producing the lycopene. And then this took us down the path of going to a lot of these nutraceutical companies and saying, what are you looking for? Mm. You know, what would you really like to start with? And that started our journey and our research into the seaweed space.
This is massive. Like, just listening to you speak just now, there is so much potential in that particular industry. Australia, please correct me if I'm wrong, imports around $1.1 billion worth of ingredients.
Correct.
Can you just explore a little bit more around why there's such a big gap with, you know, our willingness to import it and our ability to produce it? Like, to me, there seems to be a lot of potential and an interest there, but not a lot of people actually doing it.
And I think it's not for lack of will. I think historically you have to look at what's happened in the nutraceutical industry. And in the last 10 years, there's been massive growth in that space and that sector. Prior to that, if you go back 10, 15, 20 years, it was sounds a bit harsh, but it was more of a cottage industry.
Yeah.
And the supply chains for accessing ingredients were overseas, and that's just where all the products came from.
And I guess, too, there's more of a movement to really, you know where things come from, know how it's produced. At the time, it would just be like, yep, it's available there, it's cheap to bring it in, we'll do it that way. But do you think that now it is more of a social license decision-making with some of these ingredients?
I think that's exactly where it's at. And if you go back maybe 10 or 15 years, the cost of producing these things locally would have been unviable. And we've spoken to people who went down that path, and they said, we looked at setting up the equipment, we looked at the costs, and nobody was willing to pay for it. And so now we ask the question, what's changed? Why are the nutraceutical companies willing to pay more? And it's simply because the consumers are willing to pay more. Consumers want provenance. They want to know where their products have come from. They want that from an environmental perspective. They want that from a health and safety perspective. They want to know that the supply chains that it's come through, that people are being treated well, you know, whether it's the application of the new Modern Slavery Act. Because when a lot of these products come from overseas, and particularly when they're coming from third world countries, there is a bit of smoke and mirror. It's very hard to find out, where has this come from? How has it been harvested? Who's had custodianship of it along the way? And how has it been treated? And people are willing to say, now, my health is very important. I'm willing to pay a lot more for a product if I can have assurance of provenance and assurance of quality.
Fair enough. What are you researching in this whole scheme? Because there's a lot of different variations on what you just said. So where are you focusing your time, energy and money?
You're right. There's hundreds of products we could be looking at. And so instead of Field of Dreams, we will build it and they will come. We're going straight to the buyers and we're working hand in hand and we've got partnerships with the buyers. Mm-hmm. And we're saying to them, what are you after? Because there are some products that will last on the shelf for 3 months and it'll be a fad and they'll come and go. And we think we don't want to invest everybody's time and effort into those. It's too risky.
Yeah.
We're saying to them, where are your long-term winners? And that was how this project came about. We sat down with Swiss Wellness, that's part of the global H&H group, and their global headquarters are in Melbourne. And we said, what would you be interested in? And let's build a bit of a framework for those products. And they said to us that one of their biggest sellers is their krill oil, which is an omega-3 product. And so we started to look into that product and we discovered that there is an emerging vegetarian and vegan market. There is also emerging interest in the ecological aspects of the fisheries. And so they said to us, wouldn't it be interesting if we could source an omega-3 but from a vegan source? Could that come out of seaweed or algae? And so that was the premise, the start of this research project that we've undertaken.
Well, that's a fascinating insight.
First of all, we had to step back and say, let's get our head around this space and let us understand what's even simple questions we had to ask ourselves. What's the difference between seaweed and algae? And which one are we looking at? We quickly discovered that everything's called algae. Seaweed is macroalgae, but it's just easy to call it seaweed. And the sludge that you'll often find in the ponds or unfortunately some of those toxic blooms in the rivers, you know, that's microalgae, and we tend to refer to that as algae. So we said let's look at both and let's explore both. And let's go down a path of investigation. And we started to work out who could be our partners to help us in this process. We wanted to undertake and engage research. We wanted to work with and find out who was already doing any harvesting or growing, who was doing extracting. Then from there, where would it go? Into contract manufacturing. And from there, it would be ready to go into the market. So we started with the marketing companies and we said, if you're going to buy this and you're going to sell it, what are the key criteria that you're looking for? And we looked at that from a regulatory, quality, marketing, sales. We looked at global trends and we looked at the initial R&D of what was available. And we used that to build a framework. And from there, we worked backwards. We started to say, well, what strains are available in Australia? Who has a lot of the pre-existing knowledge? Let's not do research that's already been done. If we can collect existing knowledge, then that's a great start, especially if we can turn or convert that into a format that is more readily accessible for industry so they can make quick commercial decisions and really let them have their hands on the levers for deciding where they should go and maybe where they should invest, how they could start to participate in this market.
So what stage are you at now? Are you looking at, you know, really building on some of the bigger uses and being able to farm and grow more, or are you still really gathering that information?
We've gathered a lot of information and we're now ready to start sharing that information and providing some advisory knowledge to farmers and growers and even people throughout the supply chain that are interested. I mean, what we discovered was that Australia has over 12,000 different species of algae, which just blew my mind. You know, that's extraordinary. And it's almost like, you know, I started by asking the question saying, what is algae good for? But that's almost like saying what a plant's good for.
it is, and there's 12,000 of them. That's incredible.
Correct. And so you've got saltwater, so you've got marine, and you've got the typical sort of seaweed that you think of, you know, these very large, flat sheets of seaweed that wash up, and kelp that wash up on the beach, but they look majestic when they're in the ocean. Mm. And these things grow fast and tall and huge. And even with the algae, you know, most of the algae, not all of it, but much of it is freshwater and it's inland. And so we quickly started to say what strains are available, what are the uses of those strains. We connected with CSIRO in Hobart, and they host the National Australian Algae Culture Collection.
Of course they do. That's
of course they do. The ANACC. And what? They have the largest database of algae in Australia. And what's unique and beautiful about their collection is it's a living collection. So these are not just samples that have been shoved in a jar and have been around for 50 years. Every sample that they have in their jar is alive.
So now I'm imagining this beautiful room in the Saro building on the Hobart waterfront with, you know, display cases of gorgeous kelps and algae.
You're right. Yeah, it pretty much is. I mean, they're temperature controlled, but you open the doors to these rooms and they've got glass shelves on three sides. They're all lit up. And then you've got glass jars with water of different compositions, and you've got these samples of algae and seaweed living in them, and they've got different rooms at different temperatures, and they've got this vast collection. It's very impressive.
What was the premise behind that whole collection to start with? The fact that obviously there was an acknowledgement that it is a significant source,
and that collection has a very long history, and it's been going for over, If you trace back to some of the original strains, you know, over probably 50 years, even longer. And a lot of this started out as just identifying, curating and collecting and understanding what's available. But Ian Jamieson, who heads up the team down there, they do incredible research. And what I found was that there is an amazing body of work that has been done. We didn't go in and say, we need to do new research. What we ended up saying was, we have to understand the research that's been done and work out how to translate that into relevant and useful information for primary producers and everybody along the value chain. So the history, the facility there, it's a really practical one. You know, it's not just a library or a museum collection. It's a working collection.
Which have you been able to identify as having the most potential for the kind of applications that you want it to do?
We started quite broadly because we said, okay, these algae and seaweed extracts could be used for food. They could be used for vitamins and minerals. They could be used for skincare. And so we asked ourselves two questions just to simplify it for ourselves. We said, is there an omega-3 source that could come from algae, microalgae? And we found that the answer is yes. And in terms of local and native species, we found Anachloropsis australia. Australis was a really good one because it has high levels of EPA. And what I mean there is when we talk about omega-3 oils, it's not just one oil. There's actually different types. And DHA and EPA are the two types of omega-3 oils that occur in most fish oil products that you'll buy off the shelf. So we were looking for an algae that had either a good ratio or high volumes of either one of those. And so we found that, and we found that exists, they're accessible, and we've even found that there are a number of primary producers starting to grow these. They've been setting up raceways, they've been testing the right conditions to be able to grow and harvest them, and they're moving towards production.
That's innovative. They really were ahead of the game, weren't they?
Absolutely. And I think it's pretty bold. You know, you always have these industry champions who are the ones that go at the front and they lead an industry into a new era. And I think it's hard because they've had to cop a lot of the hits along the way. And they have also been very active in engaging different universities to support them through those challenges. And even though some of this is done overseas, in Australia, we've got unique conditions, we've got unique environments, and everything has to be adapted to that as well.
So please don't tell me that all 12,000 different species of algae have these components to them. You have been able to hone it down to a few good ones.
We had to ask ourselves, how do we get the list down?
And yeah, that's,
we said,
that's a
right,
lot.
Correct. So we said, let's just find large ways to knock out certain categories. Anything that was going to cause a toxic algae bloom, we just went, that's poisonous, let's not consider those. It's not to say that there might not be benefit out of those products, but we just don't want to go down that path. We didn't want the risk. So, you know, we could take 300 out immediately by doing that. Then we started to look at the ones that had good EPA and DHA oil content in them. That narrowed the list down very quickly. You know, we could get it down to about 100. Then we started to look at, well, which ones are easy to grow and which ones produce really good yield. Instead of the ones that perhaps grew too fast but didn't have good yield or grew too slowly. And so there was a lot of factors that we had to consider in the research in terms of optimising not just a good strain that technically was good but would suit commercial production.
Because that was my next question too, around the actual production, because up until now there's been a fair bit of harvesting of natural resources. The commercial application is certainly the way that you've got to go, is it?
Really interesting. We asked a lot of the buyers, we said, what's the attraction in seaweed and algae and what's the attraction in local? And the very clear answer they came back with is sustainability,
yep.
Is that these are, you know, renewable products that can be produced in a sustainable way without creating any sort of environmental damage, and they could continue and increase volume as was needed. So we thought that was a really interesting response.
Again, it comes back to what customers want.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because the other thing that came to us and they said is, can you find a natural, a vegan source of collagen that could come from perhaps seaweed? And collagen is a absolutely booming industry in the healthcare sector. So we started to look into seaweed. And even though we found traces of collagen, there wasn't enough. It wasn't present in high enough levels to be able to say, yeah, that's something we can extract. But interestingly, through the research, and this often happens in research, is you have this moment where you discover something you didn't expect and it takes you in a different direction. And we had this light bulb moment where we discovered that even though there wasn't sufficient collagen in the seaweed, there was actually a collagen degradation inhibitor in seaweed. And so this extract could stop or slow down the breakdown of collagen in the human body.
Wow. So it's even better than a collagen additive then.
That's exactly right. Because what's interesting is it's complementary to other collagen products out there. But from a commercial point of view, a lot of the commercial companies look for a marketing edge. And so if we had have just found another source of collagen, it just would have been another product on the market. But what we've essentially discovered is that this is an alternative. So it's got its own marketing category, but it supports the collagen industry. And we started working with a company in Hobart called Marinova, and they go out and they wild harvest seaweed, and they're able to actually collect, extract, and produce this product. And they don't sell the product. They on-sell to other companies that then incorporate it into their products. And they're a big producer of seaweed extract. They have a range of amazing products. They also have an extract called Phycoidin, and Phycoidin is an immunity booster, which a lot of patients that are receiving cancer treatment receive this so that it helps their immune system as they're receiving cancer treatment. But with the advent of COVID, suddenly everybody's now turning their attention to saying, wow, how can I build my immune system and make it stronger so that I'm just much more protected against viruses and all these other things that come my way? So it was a real interesting revelation to start working with Marinova and see what they're doing, how they're processing the products that they're extracting, and the way that they're leading the world in some of the things that they're doing that we have right on our doorstep here.
It's amazing that it has such a broad range of applications. How many different seaweed products would you use in your own home?
Well, I think it's opened my eyes to the opportunity. I think there's a lot of good things in there. We looked at a lot of the patents that are being registered around seaweed, and because that tells us where's all the research going, and I couldn't fit it all on one page. There's everything from stopping your hair going grey to skin protection, protecting against UV in a lot of these skin-based products, through to a lot of the food products. And some of the food products are for flavour. So you've got that umami flavour, which is that sort of wonderful flavour that I think we've probably become more aware of in the last 10 and 20 years. Then there's colouring and dyeing agents. So my wife made a bluey birthday cake for my youngest daughter, as you do. But she wanted a natural blue dye. And so the only natural blue dye that she could find was an algal beta carotene extract that comes from Australia, from BASF. They've got they're the world's largest producer of algal beta carotene. And the blue is just an incredible blue. And I had no idea. And so we've noticed as people want to get rid of artificial and go to natural, the portion of algal that's now starting to grow is increasing market share, and it's replacing a lot of the artificial. So even hair care products, I was looking at my shampoo and I thought, my goodness, that's got a seaweed extract in it. It's almost everywhere in the house, which I just wasn't aware of beforehand. I either didn't think about it, or I didn't notice, or I just hadn't read it. And sometimes they do use the scientific names as well. And a lot of those scientific names, if I'm not familiar with them, they tend to go over my head. So it is everywhere. And I think the thing for me is I started thinking, wow, how much of these are imported and how much is local?
As a researcher, how do you take that kind of information on when you're looking at emerging industries and the potential for commercial production, and yet, as you say, it's in everything in your house? What does that say to you as a researcher?
What's the gap? What's the knowledge gap that's stopping local production or local adoption of these products? And when I ask myself that question and I actually go and talk to a lot of the commercial companies, they say, well, we would buy local if we could access this specification or this price. So then that makes me go back and go, all right, so what's the best product? What's the best strain to be able to produce that product? And is one of them lend itself to being able to be produced cheaper, because we still do have to compete against cheap imports? Or is there something that can be done better out of a local product? Is there some discovery that we can undertake that will allow us to sort of leapfrog ahead of these imports and have more things done and adopted locally?
Changing tack a little bit, you were just awarded the inaugural AgriFutures Australia Researcher of the Year, which is quite an amazing title. What does that kind of accolade mean to you, and in context of the work that you're doing?
First of all, wow, I'm blown away. You know, Australia has such an incredible history and strength of research, and we do world-beating research. The work that's done in Australia is phenomenal. And to receive a personal accolade is quite humbling in that context. And, you know, it immediately makes me think that all research is done off the back of other research. And so as researchers, we stand on the shoulders of other researchers. And we always have teams around us. There's no such thing as individual research. And so I just think about all of the group that we pulled together to do this work, all of the support that we received, and how when you get your team right, when you get your framework right, you're really clear on what you're doing, you can achieve some incredible results. And especially when you're flexible in the process, research throws things at you that you didn't expect. And sometimes you hit a brick wall and you're sort of just looking at it going, where do I go from here? You know, can I salvage all this work that we've done? What does it mean? Can we translate this into something that's practical? And I find that for me personally, the thing that really gets me excited is translatable research, research that can be taken into industry to make a difference. I think back when I was a teenager working on farms, and I think about the challenges that existed on those farms, just the difficulty of being able to ensure that the farmers that we worked for had season after season of productivity. And I had the fortune of working on a diversified farm. So I saw the benefit of farmers that were willing to take risks, try different things. And sometimes those things failed. Sometimes they were really successful. And so as a researcher, I think if we're able to provide knowledge and tools and information to help those primary producers to expand, to diversify, and to access new markets, all while helping them to manage the risk, then for me, that's the driver. That's where I think there's a win, because everyone then benefits from that.
That's amazing. And as you say, you know, part of that pivoting and that application of research when you think you've hit a wall must be the biggest heartache, but then really amazing on the other side of it as well.
That's exactly right. And we find that communication's the key. We have to continually communicate with the users of our knowledge and say, is this helpful? Where can you use this? Are we headed in the right direction? And we have that feedback loop. And that really helps us to keep our focus on where we're going as well, but also to see perhaps opportunities that hadn't existed as well. But sometimes the research has been done, and we find that it'll be sitting there in a paper, in a report. And we find from an industry perspective, often it's not new research that's needed. Often it's not pure research that's needed. It's applying and taking that information and translating that into something that can be applied and used on the ground.
And, you know, communication doesn't always go hand in hand with scientists and scientific applications. Sometimes, you know, that's the really difficult part of it when your mind is preoccupied with science and research. So how difficult, or, you know, does this come naturally to you? You sound like a fairly natural communicator, or is this something that you really had to work with when you've realised the importance of some of the things that you're discovering?
I think I'm one of those people that ask questions. I'm never quite satisfied until I understand the real why of something happens, and not the superficial why or the how. I want to get down to a layer below that, and I want to get down to a layer below that. And perhaps it's just because I'm not good at understanding things straight away. I've always had to dig and dig and dig until I get an answer that I can understand, and then I can sort of build a framework. So for me, it's the scientific process, and I've adapted that and used that wherever I've gone. Even when I've not been in science, when I was in financial services, working with accountants and advisors, I would always apply the scientific method and formula to asking questions and understanding how to do things. And that always gave me a bit of a unique edge, because I found that in those environments, I would be thinking quite differently, and that would bring a fresh perspective and a fresh edge to things.
You still got quite a lot of work to do, even though, you know, you've just had this amazing discovery journey already. So if people do want to find out more information, what's the best way to?
There's a lot of information out there. First of all, the report that we produced is on the AgriFutures website, and so we encourage people to go there and read that information. And if they want more details and they want to unpack what's in that report, our contact details are on there. They can just reach out to us directly. We have more and much more deeper detailed information that we're happy to share. We're also happy to provide connections and provide networking support. Prior to us, there was a great report that was undertaken by Joe Kelly called the Australian Seaweed Industry Blueprint. That's a really accessible, usable, readable report that's available on the AgriFutures website. And we're going to have more information coming on our Sampano website as well, just in order to make all of our research readily available so people can jump in and say, great, I know I need this product, or I've got a strain in mind. Where, you know, what's the extra information that I need to know? And over the next 6 to 12 months, we're going to package that into some tools and release that and make that available.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today, Adrian. I can't wait to see what comes next.
Thanks, Jane. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for joining us. Just to remind you, we were speaking to Adrian Spencer, the founder of Sampano and AgriFutures Australia's Researcher of the Year. If you enjoyed this episode, there's plenty more to listen to on our website, or just subscribe on your favourite podcasting app. I'm Jane Cudahy. Talk to you again soon.
You've been listening to AgriFutures On Air, a podcast brought to you by AgriFutures Australia. For full access to a huge backlog of stories on Australia's agricultural trends and innovations, research outcomes, inspiring stories from our rural leaders, and insights into new and emerging rural industries, please subscribe to AgriFutures On Air on your favourite podcasting app. You can also find more information at our website, agrifutures.com.au.